the altar of books by Jack, and they're in two piles, and Ellen's going to say in the book why they're in two piles. Alan Wilfowen wanted me to mention that that Jack appointed him. He was the first appointment when Jack served as William Wise Professor of Anthropology. And that is significant in light of what we've heard throughout the afternoon just now, because Alan McFarland had worked chiefly as a historian, he worked on witchcraft, and was welcomed into an anthropology department. And it's clear to us, because Jack was so, the experience of reading Paul Michal was so formative for him. Alan McFarland then went on to write several very influential books, which I don't want to reference in detail, but they range, of course, from the origins of English individualism to studies of tea and more recently glass. But I want to particularly highlight that he also has a film channel which has many documentaries which are really invaluable, partly because they're very long documentaries of intellectual lives. And he filmed Eric Hobsbawm conducting an interview with Jack, and the year was, I can't quite recall when that was done. In the mid-80s, and I would encourage all of you who haven't seen it to look it up on YouTube, as it's very revealing to see. Over to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Monica. I'm sitting here because I'm adding to the film archive, I hope, with the camera mount ready back. I should say I have a very soft voice, but I have this as well, so if you can't hear me at the back, just wave your arms around. And I should add one footnote. I was one of Jack's first two appointments, and the other was Gilbert Lewis, so here we are still. And what I want to talk about is really about working with Jack and watching Jack over the years, an anthropology of Jack Goody in some ways, because I was trained as a historian. I didn't know anything about anthropology when he appointed me. I mean, I did nearly have a PhD. Yes, I did have a PhD in anthropology, but I still couldn't quite understand what the discipline was and what anthropologists did. And so I watched him very carefully, and I learned most of what I needed to survive in Cambridge for many years from Jack. He acted as a proto-father. When my father died, very young, and I went to see Jack, and I said, it's the middle of the term, and it's in Scotland, and he said, well, just go, I'll look after the whatever you have to do, go tomorrow. And that was just typical of Jack. And in some way, that kind of acted as a transference. So he, in many ways, for my wife and I, he acted as a proto-father for the rest of my life. So I miss him very much for that reason, as well as many others. He influenced me both through the force of his ideas and also through his personality. And he's probably the greatest influence on me as an anthropologist and as a scholar. He was a wonderful mentor in many ways. Whenever, for example, we needed equipment, I was trying to pioneer in filming and computers and all sorts of things which most people would have thought were crazy. But Jack was enormously supportive. I remember one moment in my room where they discovered pulsars in the cupboard there. I said, Jack, we need a bit of equipment, it's £300. It's 6 months until the faculty board meets, and they probably will reject my request. So he pulled out of the mass of rubbish in his pocket a checkbook and said, here's £300. And I said, well, how? He said, oh, I'll find it later. It was typical. He was, in fact, intrigued by new technologies. I remember one anecdote. When the department moved to a new site and his room was being set up, decided it would be very interesting to put a two-way mirror between the professor of social anthropology and his nearest colleague in the next room. I said, Jack, do you really want various lecturers to be watching you all the time, or are you watching them? And he thought for a bit and said, oh, well, perhaps it's not such a good idea. He pioneered in all sorts of technological ways. He built up a huge index of offprints. He purchased the human relations area files, the only person I expect in Britain who ever put out money for that. he recorded somewhat illegally generations of anthropological films and set up the best anthropological video collection in the world, probably because of that. And he started, which influenced me hugely, he started taping. He said, "Alan, my old colleagues are retiring, Maya Fortes and Audrey Richards, I should film them." So he filmed the first three with Srinivas as well. And then he retired, and I went on, and I've done something like 200 of them now. So much of my life has been blighted by the fact that I had to carry on with Jack's. It was probably a good time because the universities were still expanding, but there was competition with the archaeologists and the biological anthropologists, but because of his force of character, drive and insight, he dominated the faculty at that time, and as a result our department grew rapidly, and he even built up the technical side and got our technical assistance and so on. And so over the 10 years when between 1973 and 83, he built up the department to be one of the best and biggest departments in Europe. Anthropology, as some of you may know, has its internal feuds, and our department had had some famous feuds in the past. It's very difficult to stop your colleagues from fighting. Jack had a considerable ability to suppress feuds. He did this both at the departmental meetings and level, and also at the faculty level. One technique he taught me, which I was just discussing with someone, they said actually it's an Oxford technique, was that at faculty boards, he would sit and he would start talking. And he didn't end any sentences with a full stop. So he would say, well, you know, you remember his voice, you know, and I think we should really, and so it went on for about 10 minutes, and no one knew when they could interrupt or stop him. Some meetings would go on with just Jack talking. I learned this technique as chairman of the faculty board, and I created a record of 22 minutes for a faculty board by talking all the time. But I think if Stephen Hugh Jones is still here, sadly he beat my record with 17 minutes, having learned this technique too. But anyway, Jack was a phenomenal local politician, not at an international level. But I went from committee to committee to committee with him, watched the way he played these games, and he was just masterly. He would simulate rage. I remember he more or less drove one of our curators of our museum, Peter Gallico, to suicide by getting absolutely enraged by some small thing that Peter had done. And I could see it was all simulated, but it was just part of a complicated chess game which he performed, and he put huge energy into it. I mean, heart and soul into local politics, alongside all the creative work which we've heard about. Watching him in action taught me many practical hints about surviving in Cambridge. He said, "Don't waste time on lectures, Alan." Well, it sometimes had the effect that his lectures weren't as good as they might have been, but it saved me a lot of time because I was a very over-compulsive worrier about lectures. He said, "You know, lectures are lectures. They should be relaxed and informal. So don't spend too much time on them." And that was helpful. Don't spend time writing complicated letters to people. I was told by Malcolm McLeod when I first came here, take note of Jack's notes. You won't be able to read them probably, but they're very, very short and they're usually important. So on the back of an envelope it would say, "Alan," and then something I could read, and I would hasten to do whatever it was I interpreted to mean. He was, once or twice was offered jobs in, or at least sabbatical leaves in American think tanks, and he would say, "Alan, no, don't take that, don't go there. Waste of time. I've seen so many people go to these places, spend a year or two, not finish what they set out to do, and come back miserable. So just stay in Cambridge." And indeed, he said, "Stay in Cambridge during full term." Things have changed now, but he said, Never go away during full term for more than 2 nights. Otherwise, you just come back to a huge pile of stuff, and it just won't be worth it. We have long vacations here. It's not worth going away. What you want to do is to work full time in the Cambridge in the term times, and then clear off the first day the vacation comes. I say, well, how can I clear off? You know, my students say, I want one more supervision or whatever it is. He said, well, I'll tell you what you do. You say to anyone who wants another supervision, etc., I bought my ticket. So I said, yes. And he said, well, it doesn't matter too much what the ticket is. I usually go to the bus station and buy a ticket to Newport. But I have the ticket. So I learned this very useful piece of writing. His conversations with him and reading his material had an enormously enlightening effect. He, as has been pointed out, he was an interdisciplinary thinker. He was interested in history, sociology, economics, demography, as well as anthropology and literature. So he wasn't easy to pigeonhole, and this is why it was so exciting, because he was a lateral thinker between these. And so I found talking to him refreshed whatever I was working on. And I felt he was one of the last anthropologists of that great tradition, many of them American, like A.L. Kroeber and Ralph Linton and Lowy and others, who were the people I came into anthropology for, Levi-Strauss and so on. What are we as human beings? What is the similarity and difference of cultures and so on? These big questions is what I came into anthropology for. Anthropology, as you probably know, is a pseudo-religion. I came into anthropology when my religious beliefs were fading, and it seemed to be, in some ways, an alternative. It asks the big why questions, which religion asks. And this is why, for example, Evans Pritchard once said to me, after I'd said, well, explain all the talked to him about the great anthropologists. He said, well, Alan, all the great anthropologists are either Jewish or Catholic, which isn't quite true, but there was some truth in it, because there is an affinity to the why questions of religion, and the broad, wide, sweeping questions he was asking were the ones I came into anthropology for, and I found so refreshing. Another stimulation was his interest in material life, which we've heard quite a bit about. He was interested in computers and machines and material technology in general, and wrote a lot about technologies of production, destruction, communication, and their effects. So a whole lot of our interests overlapped, including demography, kinship, communication, and technology. And the idea of speculating at a broad level, taking India, China, Europe, Africa as Griston Mill, was a constant inspiration. You just need one or two people who set this example in your life, and then you feel confident to do it. I know that without him, both on the technological side and also on the asking the big questions, I would not have done or explored the sort of things that I had tried to explore. He was enormously productive. By the time he retired, he had published this. Apart from one or two co-edited books, and the Barbara, which I haven't got here. He retired at the age of about 65. And in the next 30 years, he published this. I won't try and lift it up. I carried it over here, so I know how much it weighs. And this isn't quite all, but mostly. And this is another enormously encouraging. Some of you are reaching retirement and post-retirement, and you're thinking, will I ever get finished with all those books I want to write? Well, I saw what a person can do between the age of 65 and 95 if they are, as he was, enormously energetic and curious. And this is a lesson for all of us because of the aging of the populations. And many academics and others are now producing their best work after retirement, and Jack is an extreme example of it. How did he do it? Well, there were various techniques. One was he worked on several books and articles at the same time, so when he got stuck on one, he would move to another one, which is a very important technique for anyone from a PhD upwards or downwards. Furthermore, he was always adding materials. Wherever he went, he would be noting things, looking at things. He was intensely curious about the minute details as well as the large patterns. He also learned the art which you have to have in Cambridge, which is to work for very short periods. When you have 10 minutes before a meeting, when you are sitting on a train and you have 1 hour, most Cambridge academics and other academics produce so little because they suffer from perpetual planning blight. They think, I've got, term is coming in 3 weeks, I really haven't got time to do much now. And so they put it off. Or they have a day in which they have 3 or 4 fragmented bits of time. He was one of the people, and I've seen it with some scientists, great scientists too, who at a meeting he would just be scribbling things down, writing, and on the back of an envelope, on the back of an agenda, he was always thinking, always writing. And I've discovered more recently that much of my best work is actually done in those pressurized moments when I've only got an hour or two. And I really haven't got much time to think, so I just write. As the author of Fahrenheit 451 had on a card on his desk, write first, think later. Creative work is done in this sort of immediate moment. And Jack was very self-disciplined and very good at doing this. His method of writing also is fascinating as one of the reasons why he could write so much. I once went to see his secretary about something, and she said, Alan, I've got this sheet of paper from Professor Goody to type up for him. And I said, yes. And she said, there's a problem. He's just got 4 or 5 words on it. It says flowers, hierarchy, Asia. Does he really want me to type this? Has he given me the wrong piece of paper? So I said, well, I don't know, but type it and see, send it back to him. So she sent it back to him, and I met her a bit later, and I said, what happened? She said, well, it was as well I did that, because I sent it back. Then I got another sheet of paper which said, flowers and kebabs are, and then China and India also, and then hierarchy and equality. And so it went on. In other words, what he did was a kind of jigsaw puzzle. His mind worked very, very fast. He talked slowly, but that's partly because he was thinking so fast ahead of his speech, I think. And so he would write and then fill it in. I mean, it's an artistic technique which you would find with painters often. They don't paint linearly. He didn't write linearly. He threw ideas at a page and then added and deepened them. And this is undoubtedly the best way to write. The only way really to write creatively is to write very fast, flow of consciousness, and then improve it. And this is what Jack did again and again. Another key was that most academics get stuck in a rut. They write their PhD on something, then they write their second book on that something, and then they don't do much more. All the best works are done in the confrontation with new knowledge. Slash and burn, in other words, Swinton agriculture. Finding out new things, and in the moment you're discovering the new things, you write them down. Books are written to educate yourself as much as the audience, and Jack's great ability was to realize this, and that's why he wrote on all these diverse subjects. He wanted to know about flowers or food or cuisine or love or whatever it was, and so he wrote a book about it. And so he was constantly moving on. He would write a book every 2 or 3 years on a new subject, and that gives a freshness to things. He wrote very fast, and in a handwriting which was only equaled by his typing in awfulness. But the results are books of great energy and insight. There was a core to his work which gives us a consistency which I think everyone else has alluded to, and I don't need to go too much into what he actually did because that's been covered in a number of the talks. He wasn't constrained at all by academic fashions. He was happy to be unfashionable, as Maurice Bloch has pointed out. He was a materialist but not a Marxist. He was interested in myth and communication but not a structuralist. He was no faddist, and he was interested in just pursuing questions irrespective. The areas of his work which have been touched on, and I won't go through the titles as they've been given to you. One is Kinship and Marriage, in which I remember David Schneider saying he thought that Jack was the greatest expert on kinship and marriage in the world, and he was certainly in the top three or four in that field in the world. The second was, has been covered, in communication, and he was undoubtedly the most interesting anthropologist working on communication of his generation, and we've heard about those books. The third was in culture and technology, which I particularly liked, and ending up with one of his last books, Metals, Culture and Capitalism. And then there was the fourth theme, which has puzzled me, which is that when he was about 83, he started on an entirely new theme, which is Eurasia, the similarities between Europe and Asia. Now, in all the years I've known him, he'd never been talking in this way or writing in this way, and he proceeded to write seven books on that theme, with which I bitterly and heartily disagree, for various reasons. But the great thing about Jack was you could disagree with him and it didn't matter. You could talk about it and that's fine. I think he was deeply wrong about lumping Europe and Asia. I've spent my life partly working in Europe, most of my historical work is in England, but then I spent most of my work in Nepal and then later in Japan and China, and I cannot see how anyone who knows those places can think that they are the same to a large extent as Asia. So we disagreed towards the end. Sometimes you'd send me some of these books with, "I'm sorry, Alan, I don't think you'll agree with this," or something like that. And he was also very courteous. I mean, quite often he'd say, "There is a younger historian," but he'd never say my name, and then he would tear me to pieces. he was always very nice about it, and it was stimulating. It's really a force to be contended with. So I want to end by noting that he was enormously kind and supportive to many of those he encountered, my own children up to his students and his colleagues. As you know, when you met him, he would put his arm round you like this and just draw you towards him. I once saw a notable, he had the habit, if you could put your hand on that, he had the habit when you were at a meeting or something, he would go like this and say, and I remember one occasion which was really delightful, with Maurice Godelier at a seminar which I ran early in my career. Maurice was sitting next to Jack, and it was being filmed, and you can watch it on my YouTube if you want. Maurice had watched Jack doing this, so halfway through Jack's speech, Maurice went like this, and Jack proceeds to the biceps bit. He was a big man in every sense. He was finally knighted, as you know, but quite late, because he was again the government. He was rather like Peter Lazett. He was a bit of an irritant to people, but in the end they had to give him his knighthood. He was in the same vein as Evans Pritchard, although they didn't get on, in that they were both anti-establishment in some curious way. He was an excellent ethnographer, a wide-ranging and innovative thinker, and he bridged the difficult years in anthropology, which was changing from the colonial period into the post-colonial period. I've met many fascinating people in Cambridge and elsewhere, over my academic career and interviewed several hundred of them for my website. But I think Jack stands out as the man who has shaped my life most and as a constant inspiration. He was a major thinker, innovator, and institution builder, and a really remarkable man. Thank you.
Great intellectual. I now hand over to Howard Descriptor, Julie Mitchell.